not quite 1/4, and never just half, but the entirety of one primate, whole. It is the part of a story, an idea that means more to you than me. Hello and welcome to Full Gorilla Life. We are Jeremy Keene,
Larry Medina,
and Corey Hewlings.
Each week, we will break down an important life concept or talk with an inspiring person so that you can live your full gorilla life.
All right, we'd like to welcome you back into the Full Gorilla Life podcast.
That's what it is. Yeah.
I almost said something else, but my word came out. I was almost came out. Anyways, the Full Gorilla Life podcast is where we're at.
That is where we're at.
And so today we'd like to welcome Brian Duncanson onto our podcast, and we're going to get to know Brian and who he is and what he does exactly. But before we do that, we'd like to start off with the Full Gorilla Gauntlet.
The Gorilla Gauntlet. So 10 rapid fire questions.
Bring it.
Nothing crazy. Married or single?
Married.
Any children?
3.
Nice. iPhone or Android?
iPhone.
Favorite movie or book?
Star Wars.
Beer, whiskey, or wine?
Hold on, wait.
Yeah.
Do you like the old Star Wars or the new Star Wars?
Old Star Wars.
Excited about this finale?
A little bit. I feel a little like they've just rewarmed the original storyline, so it's a little disappointing. I thought they would go in a whole new direction, but yeah, it's great to see the guys come back and all. So
I kind of thought the same thing. Like it's always a Death Star. Like, we're just going with a bigger Death Star. Like, come on.
They even make jokes about it in the movie. So
I'm going to be 100% honest with you. I have no idea what you guys are talking about.
Wait, what?
Death Star.
I don't. Have you never watched the full Star Wars.
Any?
None of them?
None. Not all the way through.
Well, you have some homework.
But I feel like I know that Disney paid a lot of money for it. So you guys saying that, I feel like they would have just tried stretching this out. Like,
They have.
They have?
They've been stretching it.
Since the 70s.
However, we are fully vested. I'm fully vested, and I'm going to finish it.
Obviously.
Got it. Yeah, it's too late to get out now. To answer your question, I would say it was a migration from beer to whiskey to wine now.
Okay.
Man of all traits, I got it.
Red wine or white wine, though?
Red.
Red, okay.
Health reasons or just because?
No, just because.
Okay. Taste?
Right on.
Fair enough.
Favorite genre of music?
I am a headbanger from the 80s, so heavy metal's my thing.
Okay,
cool. Metallica, or?
I go back into Twisted Sister and Whitesnake. And
do you have a favorite?
All that good stuff.
So the hair band.
Yeah, hair band age. Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, Kiss was my favorite growing up.
Okay.
So. What's your favorite Kiss song?
Detroit Rock City, still one of the best.
I'm with you. That is their hardest song, in my opinion.
One of the best.
I'm with you. All right, sorry.
No, you're good. I don't know a lot of...
I forced my wife to have a Kiss song as our wedding song.
You are my hero.
It's the one decision I got to make.
And what song was that?
Forever.
Okay. I don't think I know it.
It's a ballad.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, if her name was Beth... if her name was Beth...
Right. Her sister's name was Beth, so...
Don't stay away from that.
Okay, yeah, no.
All right. So you're going to a restaurant. Reservations or just walk in?
I would say just walk in.
Okay. Yeah. Favorite type of food?
I like a steak, like a nice filet.
Okay.
Is that our first steak? Because I feel like that's...
I think it is.
Because we all three would probably agree with you there.
Have you ever had Wagyu?
Yes.
The A5?
Yeah.
Well, all right. So
where'd you have it at?
Let's talk about this for a minute.
I'll see you guys. We'll be back in about 10 minutes. No, just go ahead.
Naboo at Atlantis down in the Bahamas.
How was it?
It was pretty spectacular. And they were paying the bill because we were on an official visit. So
makes it even more spectacular. Yes.
Oh, man.
It's like magical, isn't it? Like, yeah, it's not like anything I've ever eaten.
No. It was the weirdest thing. So me and Corey split a Wagyu and A5. By the way, it was like a 2 ounce?
Yes.
It was 2 ounces.
Now, we ordered 20-ounce ribeyes, each of us. But then, you know, the Wagyu...
For the appetizer.
2 ounce was like... $55 or something like that.
Yeah, and we're like, all right, we're gonna splurge because we gotta try it out, right? We're steak people, and we're gonna just give it a shot. And the thing is, like, it has a lot of hype for me. Like everything I've read, it has a lot of hype.
Yeah, I didn't want it to be as good as what it was because I was like, "There's no way."
You thought it would be no way. Like, there's no way it's gonna.
I was
be
like,
this
"There's
good.
No way all these videos I've watched can be true." There's no way.
There's no way. I'm with you,
and I was very skeptical.
And then we cut into the and first bite, like, and I was like, "Okay."
They right. crossed arms and like ate and fed each other. Like,
yeah, like Lady and the Tramp.
Right on.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, that's why we do it, right? What do you drive?
Ford Explorer.
And the city you live in?
Vero Beach.
Right on.
Nice. All right. All right, Brian. So yeah, so if you don't mind maybe giving our audience a little bit of background, right? So currently you work for? Spartan Race. All right. And me and Corey actually did the Spartan Race in Fenway last year.
Okay.
That was awesome. A lot of fun. I would love to do it again. It was a lot of fun.
We completed it. I wouldn't.
You didn't say you raced
we
it.
Didn't
you
just competed. We didn't really compete. We completed.
We completed. Which, by the
there.
Way,
I was there actually.
Were you?
Yeah, with my daughter. Yeah, we happened okay. to be up in the.
Can you swing across those baseballs? Like, do you have that much talent?
Across the what?
The baseballs.
The obstacle.
Those are difficult. The baseball grips are very challenging.
I was horrid. Yeah. I basically went one and out.
And it was wet. It was raining.
Oh, yeah. Cold. And there, we're Florida boys. So yeah. Cold, wet, raining does not mix well with us at all.
All that we had was a shirt and I had some sweatpants and he had some like.
Yes, because we got talking. We got shamed. No, we got shamed into this. Okay. Because this we were the only two Florida boys there and the group we were running with was like,
Tammy.
Come on, you wusses. I mean, for lack of a better word, right. They're like, come on. So they we were couldn't in be like.
In shorts and stuff?
They were in regular clothing. And we're like shivering.
You're shaking.
We're like, all right, we got it. You know, but okay. it was a great time, honestly.
Yeah, it was spectacular.
And going into Fenway and going through the locker room, you guys did a spectacular job.
Yes, it was. Yeah,
so I actually, I had a big hand in putting that together. I don't know, it was probably 2014 or so, and somebody from the Red Sox contacted us, and, you know, the idea seemed crazy at first, and so I said, oh, let's go check it out, and our original thought was we were just going to close the streets down outside the stadium and have kind of a street sprint. We thought it'd be cool to be in the city, have something cool going on there, and then we started bringing me on the tour inside and walking around and started pacing it out. And I'm like, I think if we went up and down the stairs enough and back and forth that we could stretch this and maybe get a mile and a half. Well, I went and did it out and I actually wound up over 2.5 miles the first time I went through it. And I said, this is fantastic. I just go everything. So it took some convincing. CEO didn't want to do it. He thought it was a horrible idea. That was
who,
so different.
Who didn't want to do it now?
Our CEO.
Oh, your CEO.
Yeah. That was a horrible idea. It's just very different than what sure. we were doing. We were out in the idea was to get out of that, get out into nature, get back to your sort of primal self. And, so it was sort of against the grain. But finally saw the light and, as well as he's not a sports guy.
Okay.
So he didn't really get the Fenway attraction and didn't realize that people pay on any given day $40 just to go on the tour.
Yeah.
Just to go walk around for a little bit and take
just
pictures.
Just go up on the Green Giant.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
Green Monster.
Oh, yeah.
So
Green Monster, yes. I'm sorry. I'm not a baseball guy. I'm a sports guy, but I'm not.
What'd you say? Green Giant? Yeah. Are we eating green beans over here?
Yeah. Exactly.
But yeah, but going behind the Green Monster.
He did.
Yeah, but
you don't get credit for that.
I'm trying to.
Yeah, but going behind the Green Monster for me, that was easily the coolest thing.
Yeah.
I was actually running. I was way ahead of Corey. And then I stopped and I was like, let me take a look. Because it was actually really cool.
Brian, I don't remember that. Okay. I don't remember that at all.
You're too cold?
I had to check the video too.
I think he skipped a couple.
I might have. So they contacted you. Your CEO was not.
Yeah, it took some convincing because it was a new product for us. But we made it work. We did it the first year. We've been there ever since. And actually now we have a full set of trailers dedicated to just stadium events.
So that was your first stadium out of the stadium series?
The very first one, yeah. It was Fenway, yeah.
So what other stadiums do you guys do?
Now we're in, like I said, 10 to 12 just here in the U.S. alone. So we have a Cowboys Stadium. AT&T Stadium.
That would be awesome.
I'm a big Cowboys fan too, so
I'm not, but that seems phenomenal.
That was a big, it was a big moment for me.
Is that one still just?
And we get to finish right on the. They let us right on the field, the turf field there.
On the star.
Right on the star. Run right across it.
That's pretty cool.
It's pretty cool.
Oh wow.
I got to do that.
It's pretty similar, I think, to Fenway and being able to be on the field and go in the dugouts. And
when does that one take place?
That one's usually in the summer months because it's enclosed in that, and we're outside of the football season.
Do I get to see myself on the big screen?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The TV cameras are on. It's a 9-story high, that screen.
Yeah, it's huge.
It's 60 yards long. I mean, it's massive. That's crazy. It's pretty crazy. When they brought me in there for the first meeting, they took me up to the boardroom. You know, you kind of come in the back way, you go in the elevators, yada, yada, and then you pop into this boardroom, which has all glass windows overlooking the field, and you're right at the level of the TV, and they've of course got highlight reels rolling all the time and stuff when there's people in there.
As a Cowboys fan, that was probably just incredible.
Oh yeah.
So did you get to meet Jerry?
No. He didn't come to the meeting.
He didn't come to the meeting.
Okay, well, I was curious.
Hey, listen, he was probably sick.
I would have had a thing or two to say to him. But.
So fair enough. With Spartan, you kind of mentioned that you're there. How did you get started with Spartan? How did that come about?
Well, I guess origin story, you got to go back to the late 1900s, early 2000s. And I was, I was just working a job. I was living in Connecticut and working a job for a software company and sort of wanting to get back into sports again in a quality way. I swam in college and kind of did nothing after that. Started playing golf and drinking. And then
I know the feeling.
On the TV, it was Eco Challenge, if you've heard of that or remember it. It's back when it was just sort of getting started. And, used to be on Discovery Channel and then that. And I was captivated by that style of, I'd never seen anything like it. These guys were going for days on end.
Those go for a long time.
Cross country, 6-7 days. So what started out of that, some other companies started to replicate that style of racing with shorter distances. And one of those races happened to come to Connecticut every year. So a friend of mine I knew was involved in it, so he started getting involved, started racing. And then I just kind of lit the passion, because it's trail running, mountain biking, paddling, navigating. And then you have a team. So usually in a team of three in those races, and they'd had obstacles actually then. And you had to get over them as a team, figure out the most efficient way. So we got into it and eventually wound up getting sponsored by Guinness Beer Company. And we wound up racing for 3 years. Part-time while we were still working our full-time jobs as Team Guinness, and we got to go all over the country.
Race, had to be incredible.
Really, really cool spots. So then as that was going on, I realized that this one Connecticut race was like the only one in the Northeast that happened, and there would be like 1,000 people showing up. And in the early 2000s, have 1,000 people show up at a sporting event that wasn't like the New York City Marathon was amazing. Like, just didn't happen.
And on top of that, like, how'd they get the information, right? Like,
oh, it was just all email lists. You kind of had to know somebody.
They're really looking for
somebody.
This.
Yeah, you had to really dig and find out about it to figure it out. You know, websites were just becoming a thing, so you had to really.
Yeah, it was probably more word of mouth than anything.
Yeah, you had to really work it.
Or you're really searching for it, right? So there's a real need for it.
Yeah. So eventually, 2001 happened. And right after that, I decided that I didn't want to be in an office anymore. And broke out and started my own business promoting and executing sporting events. And it started with adventure races. So putting on smaller ones all through New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, Massachusetts.
So if you don't mind my asking, what was that risk like for you, right? Because you're leaving. This is what I always think of, like people leaving a secure job, right? There's a lot of reasons why I can't do it, right? Because I have security, I have a wife, I have a son, have X, Y, Z.
It's a lot of excuses.
A lot of excuses.
Why you can't do
it. So how did you manage those aspects, if you don't mind my asking?
Yeah, 100%. It's a great question. I was 27 at the time. had a six-figure job in a software company in sales, had a big, just bought a big house in Connecticut, probably more than we should have bought at the time. And I think we just had, my wife just had our second child.
Oh, geez. So you were in.
So you had all those.
So we had all these things stacked up and yeah, it just wasn't happy anymore and was just wearing on me. And I had, I had my MBA, I had my, some business experience and felt like I could make this fly. So yeah, it was everything at risk. I mean, we had to effectively ended up, remortgaging our house several times in order to keep paying bills. My wife's a physical therapist. So in addition to taking care of the kids and dealing with all of that, she worked part-time as well. And, we strung it together for several years.
So this is a complete leap of faith. And you're just like, we'll just figure it out as we go, pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, I had a small business plan, but everybody has a plan.
An idea, a little small plan, but it probably never goes exactly.
Yeah, filling out a spreadsheet's one thing, making the numbers like really happen, and making Mike Tyson's, the cash register. Like
Tyson says, I always think of that Mike Tyson quote.
Everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face, you know? When the real world comes knocking and those bills are due, then it's like, oh, wait, the plan...
Yeah. Well, I remember. So it was a great.
Please see my spreadsheet.
It's like, a great spreadsheet. The spreadsheet said this was going to work. What had happened was I went to an adventure racing camp that was put on by a Navy SEAL down in West Virginia, and it was great. It was for a week, and we just spent the whole time learning how to rock climb, rappel, whitewater raft, and paddle. Mountain bike, navigate both day and nighttime navigation. It was just awesome. And then there was a 100-mile race at the end of it that we did and did it. And I'd never done anything remotely near that type of distance before. So that was really cool. It inspired me and saw what they were doing and saw that there were a lot of people who wanted to get into the sport that didn't know how to get started. So that's how I got started. I actually started some training camps. So I put up a website and said, okay, I'm going to start hosting some camps and teaching people the skills on a weekend basis. You can come out on a Saturday and Sunday, and we can knock off a lot of these things. And I just loved it. It was great. And I got hired by, somehow they found me, a group from Oregon. And they emailed me, and they said, hey, we got a group of like 20 people that want to get into this. How do we do it? So I quoted them a price. They paid it and flew me out. Oregon. I had a friend out there who lived there, and together we put on a clinic for them. And I flew back and quit my job that Monday. I was like, this was such a high.
Yeah, I can understand.
So
that.
Where, when you were doing like the weekend camps, where did you do that at?
We'd find parks, state parks and things that allowed mountain biking and that had access to water.
Okay.
Yep. And then we'd bring equipment there and. Set up. We'd buy topographic maps and compasses, and
so did you have like a waiver of sorts, or were you just
We had a waiver at the time. Yeah.
Okay.
I said you might die.
right. Yeah, put that in there somewhere.
Yeah.
So
don't do this unless you've consulted a physician.
So then, so that was like in the early spring. And then I started planning my first race to put on. So again, having never organized a full race from start to finish, started planning and set up registration, and people were starting to sign up. So it was getting exciting, it was starting to approach. I think it was like maybe May, the first event was going to happen in Connecticut. And, so I needed to get kayaks. The race directors always provided the boats, mm-hmm. the kayaks. And fortunately, there was an inflatable Intex. Just, they make your pool floats and things. They made these inflatable versions of the kayaks. So placed an order for them. Going to be here 3 weeks before the race, whatever. Get everything else going. And the kayaks were supposed to show up, didn't show up. Called the company, they go, oh yeah, we're out of all those.
Oh,
can't have
thanks
them.
For letting us know.
Now this is literally like 4 days before the race now, and I've got like 70 teams showing up,
and they're expecting a kayak.
They're expecting a kayak.
And now you're like BYOK.
Well, we thought about it. We thought about this strategy. We were like, no, I can't go that way. So we literally, like, the next day, I called up three of my friends, and, you know, we just went to, like, the sporting goods store, and each one had, like, three, and we had to drive around half the state to collect enough, and we only wound up with maybe 20 of them, like a third of what we needed. So then I had to improvise, and I said, okay. And the good news about adventure racers, they're very flexible, right? Triathletes, zero flexibility, right?
I can see that. Like, they're very, like, the
adventure,
rules.
Very linear, they're very type A. Like, you mess up a sign, twisted the wrong way, they will flip out. Adventure racers were so laid back, and just the whole thing was like, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm just going to deal
with
it.
Yeah.
And I'm good with it. And it was very frequent to have surprise challenges popped into the races, which I loved. So it was a thinking person's sport, you know, just because you were going to be faster on the run and the bike didn't mean you were going to beat me, because there were shortcuts to be had, and there was teamwork to work on. And there were these other surprise things that the race directors would orchestrate to amp up the challenge. So I split the group into three different groups. They had three disciplines. They had to do a run, they had to do a bike, and they had to do a paddle. And I just gave them different orders. I just made up three different instruction sheets and gave them
different orders. So
everybody went with it. Everybody loved it. And
how many races did you have for that first event?
There's 140 people there.
Wow. 70, so it was a team of two?
Teams. Yeah, we just did teams of two. To get started. Again, we were trying to lower the barriers, make it easy for people. We were shortening the distances so that people could finish.
So you made essentially you made your first paycheck when you went to Oregon, but now this is a real thing.
I'm losing money. Now I start losing money.
Okay.
Okay. Well, yeah. Yeah.
Now you're on our level.
Yes.
Now we understand.
Startup.
We're very good at that.
Startup mode. Yeah. So now, yeah, you have to spend all the money up front to make your reservations, all the equipment, marketing.
Now, did you have to rent like a park or something when you did that first?
We'd have to pay a permit fee to the parks. They're pretty reasonable in the state at the state park level.
Okay.
When we started out, so it wasn't crushing, but you know, every little, you're counting every dime. And
marketing is expensive.
Yeah. Well, and it was less expensive back then, but you also couldn't reach a lot of people. So what you needed to do, right, in an event, you always you have your fixed cost. Basically, whatever it costs to put the first person on course, you know, and then you have your variable costs. So if you can get over your fixed costs, you can start catching up fast and start making some good money if you can get good attendance. But it was very challenging to do, so it took a while.
Wow. Yeah. So now you're losing money, right? As you mentioned. So a lot of people won't understand that, right? Because they'll be like, oh, well, you just did a race, right? And you got your number of folks to sign up.
140 people to pay you to come here.
Right. So how are you losing money?
You, like, must be rich.
So, right. A lot of people think that, right? Because you're an entrepreneur and you have paying customers. So people do think that. So how do you get over that hump? Or maybe the question is, what happens next?
Well, I just started doing the math and said, you know, I have to get, you know, 100 teams at each race, get to 200 people. Then I've got a little bit of margin, and then I'm going to have to do not four races like I planned for the first year. I'm going to have to do 10. I'm going to have to do 15. So that's what happened. The progression over the next couple of years started to expanding. And then the other thing was adventure racing was a niche sport. You know, you had to have mountain biking skills, paddling skills, be comfortable. Even runners, like a lot of road runners won't trail run. They don't like it.
Yeah.
Afraid of twisting ankles. So then we had to branch out. We started branching out into more mainstream sports. So started putting on a triathlon. That's why I know what triathletes are like. Started putting on road races and more traditional sports, mountain bike races, anything we could find that people were interested in, and that we could try to make some money off. And some worked and some didn't.
So how long did you do that for?
Genesis is still going today. The company's name is Genesis Adventures, and it's still alive today. Still put on a few events a year.
Okay, and this is your company?
Yeah, it's my company.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
So are they still adventure races then?
No, we don't do any more adventure races. We just have, we still have a triathlon that we put on in New York State. And then we put on a half marathon in Westchester, New York. And then the last couple of years, we started a Florida coast-to-coast running relay. So that's okay. A team of 12.
There's a few of those, I think, isn't there?
Like a Ragnar?
Yep, exactly.
Is it coast to coast, like Vero to Tampa, or where is it at?
We've been starting at Titusville.
Okay.
And then we finish in Tarpon Springs, right on the beach in Tarpon Springs.
That doesn't sound bad. When is that?
That's in April.
Doesn't sound bad.
We can be ready.
Yeah.
How many miles?
Yeah. What's is the?
It's 200.
Oh.
What's the teams? Bad. Is it a team of three?
Usually do 12.
Oh, for 200 miles?
Yeah, we could do that.
Yeah.
That's not bad.
Yeah, I feel pretty good about that.
Yeah. It doesn't sound that bad, honestly. 12 people.
It's pretty fun because what happens is
the problem is getting 12 people.
That's one of the challenges. But there's 36 legs, so with 12 people, you just run three legs. So you'll run your leg, and then you're off for the next 11. You got time to rest, recover, sleep, eat, whatever you want to do, and then you're back on. And each one, they vary in distance, but they're average around 5.5 miles.
That's not bad.
No, that's not
bad. I feel like we could do that.
So the support, how does that work? The support van, like, follows them or goes out in front of them?
Yeah, we usually actually have two vans. So one van will have half of the crew in there, and they'll just bounce to the next location, the transition area, we call it.
Okay.
And they'll just pick you up and off you go, and they follow you along. And then you'll hand off to the other van. You'll have several hours off to go chill out.
So what's the name of that race?
It's Florida Coast to Coast Relay.
Oh, okay. I like the name. I think I've seen that.
How many years have you had that one? I feel like I've seen that one before.
This will just be the third year coming up. Okay. So we've had it twice.
Okay. Have you ran that?
I biked the entire thing because I scouted it out and then went back and measured it. I've biked the whole thing. It follows the Florida Coast to Coast Trail. So state of Florida has spent several multi-millions of dollars to put together these, paved trail components.
Oh, okay.
And
so a lot of it
is now just about connect all the way across the state. There's a few breaks where we have to go on roads or sidewalks and such, but 85% of it's on.
Oh, that's awesome. Because I'm thinking I'm going to be running on the side of the road.
Yeah. Nope. Only.
That really doesn't sound like a bad run at all.
It sounds like fun.
It's a really nice places. April. Really gorgeous places.
Okay. I'm in.
That's our, yeah.
Let's do it.
All right. We just got to find some nine more people.
So listeners, if you're out there,
our friends are not that.
Losing, Rob,
listeners.
Wendy.
Yeah.
All right. You listen.
Yeah. All right, let's get them in. They'll do it. All right.
So it was during that time or the venture racing that, one of the guys who showed up very early was a Wall Street guy. And maybe the second year I came rolling into one of my races. We normally started at 8 o'clock in the morning. And he came rolling in with another guy. They were already on their bikes. And turned out they had been riding all night long. Out of the city. We were in New Jersey. And the other guy was Joe DeSena, who's the CEO of Spartan. So he came out. He was still a Wall Street trader and super into fitness and endurance, and came out to the race, did the race, and then wound up hiring me to put on a private event for his clients in the Hamptons. So
was Spartan a thing at this time?
No. This is pre-Spartan. It's early 2000s. And so we went out and put on this adventure race, which was a cool little course. It was out at the end of Long Island in the Hamptons. Went through state parks. And he told me it was a few friends. It was going to be like 20, 30 people. We show up on the day and there were, I think, 90.
Ooh.
So, again.
Just 20, 30.
Just adapt.
Now, he comes to you to do that. Did you have to sell it to him at all?
He wanted to do this for for his clients.
So he already knew you.
He had all these people who were drinkers and smokers on Wall Street. And here he was, really taking on this fitness lifestyle. And
I'm just wondering, was there any sales pitch there? Was it like I'm not the cheapest, but I am the best?
Look, he was on Wall Street. He had money.
Yeah.
So he paid the bill.
Okay.
For me, it was a good consulting gig at the time.
Okay. Cool. Yeah.
We almost lost a team on the beach. We did lose a team for a while on the beach, and we couldn't figure it out because we literally made it through the whole race. And the last thing was to finish the bike, and we put you on the beach literally, and you had to go go down the last 4 miles to the finish line on the beach. Like,
yeah, you just go, you just keep going.
Just go, right?
Keep the water on your...
When these people didn't show up, we're like, what the heck is going on? We doubled back. We were looking for them. We were like, they're not there. They're not there. What happened? Finally, they wound up coming in, and they all had drinks in their hand. They parked off, drinking and smoking on the way down the beach.
Yeah, so I was going to say, was alcohol involved?
I was feeling like that's where it was going to.
No, yeah. I feel at the end, there's always like, you always have a beer at the end or what have you.
Yeah, afterwards, yeah, they had a party and everything, so that was fine. But then Joe bought a property up in Vermont the next year, and we did a race up there the following year. And then he wanted to start a business like mine to put on events in his hometown to draw people up to the town, which is just north of Killington, Vermont. And I said, well, I got my thing going. I don't really want to, it's not where I want to be. It's not what I want to do. So we kind of, you know, friendly parted ways. And then it was about 4 years later when he gave me the call and said, I got this idea. He had started an event called the Death Race, which was basically a nonlinear series of challenges, let's call it, that were unannounced. That took place over the course of a weekend. So it was really it was physical, of course, but it was a mental challenge and just kind of like SEAL training, like trying to get people to break, find their edge and then either push beyond it or drop out and learn something from it. So then he, he had this idea to kind of democratize it somehow and go out with it. And it was just at the beginning, company called Warrior Dash had started this obstacle race, which was very sort of similar to some of the adventure races we did, but without the biking and the paddling. It was just running and obstacles. So like, oh, okay, that's pretty cool. And they started getting some pretty big crowds. So we kind of took that model and adapted it and came up with the Spartan brand and boom. Yeah.
Is Warrior Dash still around?
They just folded this year.
I was going to say, I ran one of them probably soon after they first started.
Me and Jeremy did for sure.
Yeah, we did one over in Lake Wales is one of those.
Yep. I was about to say, all I hear now is Spartan.
Really? There was a few. I feel like there was quite a few that kind of came up. Savage Race was one. And then I feel like the only one I hear now is Spartan Race is the only one I really
definitely the market leader now. Nice.
Congrats for that, because that's cool.
Yeah, that is awesome. So what does it take to get all of those things coordinated, right? Because, I mean, you're going throughout the whole U.S. They're everywhere. You're hitting the different stadiums and just open fields. So obviously, like, as far as the coordination, like, what is that?
It's pretty massive. We started small and humble. The first race was in Vermont. We had 500 people there. But again, as I remind you, like, that day and age, to have 500 people for a first time event that nobody had ever heard of, we were like, that's interesting, you know? So we started out small with some wood trailers, and then we got our first tractor trailer and went from there. So now, now this, you know, we have five separate fleets of trailers that service the U.S. And each fleet has eight trailers in it full of stuff that we bring in, because like you said, sometimes we're in farm fields and there's no infrastructure whatsoever. So yeah, it's a multi-month planning process prior to the event, both from a marketing perspective. You're obviously marketing and trying to sell the tickets ahead of time. At the same time, you're also planning the logistics, and that's always a challenge because you're always kind of watching, you know, your registration, and you want to make sure you have enough supplies for how many people are showing up. Not too few, that pisses people off, and not too many because that wastes money. So there's a lot of nuance to it. And then, you know, the event itself now probably takes around 60 staff members on the weekend to execute. We have our core team of builders that go out and assemble the course, and there's, 12 to 14 people on that crew that are there for the whole sort of cycle. Then a larger crew comes in for the weekend to man the event. And then we have volunteers. We'll use anywhere between 500 to 800 volunteers on a weekend. It's a big enough race. So all that, you got to recruit the volunteers,
There's a lot of prep work. Yeah. How long do they have to get there early to start building? How in advance they usually do that?
Typically, we're there around 10 days in advance. Some of the bigger events, longer. But try to squeeze it down to 10 days because, again, like time on site is money being spent. You have people there that have to eat. They're in hotels. They're burning gas, et cetera. So,
when he calls you and says, hey, I want you to come do this, are you automatically at that point where you're like, okay, I'll come do it, but you still have your other company too? Was that a discussion like, hey, I'm not dropping what I already started? Or...
Well, yeah, he didn't want me to at the beginning. He didn't know it was going to work either. None of us knew. So it seemed kind of like it was basically a contracted project.
Okay.
Is how we set it up initially. So, he came to me in basically the meeting, the paper napkin meeting was in Hartford, Connecticut. We had actually just come down to Vero and decided we were going to move here that year. We moved down here that year from Connecticut. We'd gone back to visit family, had the meeting the day after Christmas in 2009. And so it's already the end of December. And he's like, I got this idea. Here's some money. I want 10 races. And we said, okay, you're talking about like 2001, right? Like we'll use the year to plan. And he's like, no, next year or 2010, I should say. So we're like, okay. So yeah, so we had from December and we put our first event on in May in Vermont and had it. So it was, we just had a group of contractors at the time. It wasn't sort of like a traditional Silicon Valley startup, like big pile of money. It was just enough money to get things, prime the pump and test out the theory. But we had already also planned several additional events for the year. So we wound up executing 7 events that year. And by the last event of the year, we had over 2,000 people show up.
Wow, that's good proof of concept there.
Yeah, it is.
So yeah, we knew it by, we had a pretty good feeling at the first event when 500 people showed up in like northern Vermont, like outside of Burlington for this, new company, new event format. We went to Montreal second. There was a girl who worked on the project who was Canadian. So we actually went to Montreal for our second event. Thought we'd, hey, what the heck, we'd go out of country.
worked so well here for 500.
Then we came back into New York in Boston, and we already broke, 1,000, I remember, in New York, and then like 1,500 or 1,700 or something like that in Boston, outside of Boston, for like our fourth event. And we're like, okay, like this is getting real. So then there were definitely discussions at that point, to sort of formally form up the separate company. 'Cause he had his event company that he had started, and we were operating kind of under that umbrella. And we said, well, this has got to get broken out and do this separately. So finally got it formed. And then, it still proceeded like that for several years.
How many events do you guys do now a year?
In the United States, we have 67 events this year and over 100 internationally. Wow. So we're in 40 different countries.
And that includes the Stadium Series too, I assume?
That's what the Stadium Series included.
That's all right, incredible. So you're going through all this, but at some point you get some pretty horrific news.
Yeah, so that was 5 years ago. I was at my dentist visit.
Okay, so like 2014?
It's 2014.
So about 5 years after you started with Spartan?
Yeah, it's 5 years. It's humming along. It's going gangbusters. Things are getting really crazy because we're in a, we were duking it out with Tough Mudder and Warrior Dash for supremacy and all that. So there's growth pains. So we're hiring people. People are leaving. You get staff issues as well as, marketing world is changing. So a lot of pressure, a lot of stress going on. And I remember I went up north again for Christmas and got sick, which isn't unusual, going up there that time of year and coming back. And then just wasn't shaking. And I was playing a lot of tennis at the time. And, I got a bruise on my leg, a couple sort of purplish bruises. And at the time I was like, oh, I must have just got hit by the tennis ball or something. Wasn't unusual for me to fall down or get hurt or something. So I didn't think anything of it. And then I wound up going to my dentist visit, and they're doing just a regular teeth cleaning. And with the flossing, my gums just started bleeding nonstop. And they were like, whoa, like, time out. Something's not right here.
Wow.
So sent me to the clinic, had a blood test. And yeah, it was like, they're like, you have leukemia.
Wow.
Just like that. Just like that.
So they caught that. Did they catch it early?
No. it had obviously been around. That's what the sort of my symptoms, my body was starting to manifest itself. So they had taken the reading. So the type of leukemia I had was the body is basically producing bad white blood cells. So you wind up with an abundance of them, higher than normal counts. And so normal humans got between like 4,000 and 10,000, let's call it, on the scale. Mm-hmm. I was up at 50,000. And that was one of the marks later when we did the research. They're like, you know, if we can catch it before you get to 50,000, it's usually pretty good.
Okay.
I was already at 50,000.
Okay.
And I remember, so my brother-in-law is a regular doctor in Orlando. So like we got the news, we're like, wow, that's unbelievable. So we called him. He's up with Florida Hospital, his good friends, the head of oncology there. So he called him, chatted with him, called back. He's like, all right, like, yeah, you should think about, and this was Thursday or Friday, but he said, you know, by Monday you should be checking into the hospital, you know. I'm like, okay. So we're trying to digest that. And he called me back, I think 15 minutes later, he goes, you know, he called me back again. I told him your counts and he said, you need to go tonight.
So if you don't mind asking, like, so you have a state of mind of humming along, you're crushing it, life is fantastic, right? You're doing everything that you want to do out of life, essentially. At least that's my take, outside mm-hmm. perspective. Then you get that news, like, when the doctor tells you that, like, what is your, because, like, you're on such a high, and then you're getting told this, like, so what is...
Like, your mindset?
Yeah, like how do you...
Well, for me, I mean, it's like any kind of news like that, I think. I mean, you're definitely in some shock at first. Your brain's trying to process this. Like, is this happening to me? Like, you know, working out at the gym, I'm running, I'm playing tennis. Like, life's
the hell
fine. And like, what the heck? Yeah. So it was a little bit of shock. And then, you know, for me is more discovery. Like, I don't know, you know, we don't know what the news is. Like, how bad is it? You know, what's the next step, basically? So, you know, that news sort of started coming quickly, and, you know, start being able to put together a plan and know what's going to happen. And then, you know, in this case, you really did not much to do other than hand yourself over to the professionals and let them go. I mean,
so did you check in that night?
We did. Yeah. Yeah. Took me right up and, checked in that night. Through a central line in to the tube, and took a day. I think they didn't start the chemo till the second day.
Oh, so immediately they're like, we're just going to start you in chemo?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, the treatment, you know, they got enough read on it early that they had a, you know, they had their basic playbook for the plan. So it involved... First round of chemo and hospital stay that lasted almost a month, because basically they crush all white blood cells. They just take them all out, take you down to zero, and then they let your body reboot itself. And in a perfect world, you'll stop making the bad ones was a fluke, and your body will just regenerate good cells. And it worked. The first round put me into remission, which they were pretty astonished by. So that was good. There was follow-up rounds. They wanted me to go through three more rounds called consolidation. So it was, again, going back to the hospital, chemotherapy, being brought down to zero, and resetting. It's kind of the protocol.
So even though they brought it, kind of worked the first time, it's just the continuation of doing that multiple times to make sure
Make sure it sticks.
It's just kind of, it's not one.
Kind of the protocol to make sure it sticks. And then in the meantime, you know, they had sent out the DNA to a lab to get sort of fully tested, which took several weeks to come back. And that came back, and the prognosis then was that based on the sort of subtype of genes that I had, that I was going to need a stem cell transplant. So the head of the transplant division came in and sort of going over that with me. And then started going having at odds with my oncologist. Oncologist felt that his course of action was good enough and that I was going to be good to go after that. The other guy was telling me different. Now, of course, he's a stem cell guy. He wants to do a stem cell transplant, right? But, you know, you're talking about, like, life and death here, potentially.
Yeah, to make you feel real warm and fuzzy
wasn't
inside.
Good, it wasn't good that they weren't all on the same page.
Right. That's a, yeah.
Yeah. So that was a little disconcerting. So we wound up going to the Moffitt Center in Tampa to get a third opinion. And it was just the fact that, so the type of the leukemia comes in sort of many different flavors, if you will. Bad analogy, but... and the type that I had was a pretty aggressive kind. And the fact was that about, you know, 5 to 7 years earlier, it was pretty much a death sentence. Wow. So they'd only recently evolved the treatments to the point where they were starting to have some success. But the data sets weren't big enough to really have it all mapped out for everybody. So that's why I was kind of in this gray area. They're, you know, kind of both of them could have potentially been right. Let's say that.
Okay.
But ultimately decided to go with the stem cell transplant because it was a little riskier on the procedure. But the doctor was like 100% confident that with a good match, that you'd be done at that point. Where the other route, there was sort of this uncertainty that you could relapse. So it's like, I don't know if I want to have that floating around in my head all the time, right? That's a tough way to...
Yeah, that's going to just linger.
Yeah, because if that comes back, right, then you'd be like, oh, I should have went with the stem cell.
Yeah, and you could try to do it later, but I was like, I kind of want to... I'm dealing with this now. I'm kind of in that mindset.
Yeah,
I want to come back and...
Let's
do
get
it again in 2 years.
Everything we got right now. Yeah.
So how long did that take? You got diagnosed to where you're at.
So it was about 6 months time to get through that. So they did find a donor, and they match you on a scale of 1 to 10, and they found a perfect 10 match with me. So they felt really good about that, and so they did the transplant that June, and. You know, that again was a 3 to 4 week hospital stay. So just...
And did you have that done over at Moffitt then?
No, that was done at the Florida Hospital. Yeah, stayed Florida there
in Orlando.
So Orlando, yeah.
To be near you, because did you have high trust in your brother-in-law? Is that why? Or?
Well, yeah, and the infrastructure there. Both my mom and my sister lived there.
Perfect.
So when we would go up there, my wife had a place, the kids had a place to go, and they could kind of play and not be... in the hospital all the time, and my wife could leave them and come in.
So I think about, like, because you say you're going along, you have a pretty busy life, you have 3 kids, and this hits. Like, how does your mindset play there? Like, what, do you just change perspective? Like, does that really change your way of perspecting on life?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, obviously it probably does, but I mean, like, what does that make you think about that? Does that make you...
Well, I wanted to dig in. So as soon as, you know, they hooked me up, you know, I'm in the bed and... you know, they hit me with the drugs and then it's clear that I'm going to be here for several weeks. But I, you know, I had my, told to bring my computer in and as long as I felt good, I was going to keep working. So in fact, I didn't tell anybody at work for first two, three weeks.
See, that, really? That's incredible though, because when I'm sitting here thinking, like, most people get that type of news and they're like, I'm quitting my job. I'm going to do what I always wanted to do. But you've already taken that leap of faith. You know, you've jumped out of the cubicle. You wanted to do adventure racing. That's what you're doing now. And now you tell me that you get the news and you're like, well, I'm digging in. I'm going to keep working. Like, that to me is somebody that really has a passion for what they're doing and not like, just like, you know.
Doing it to pay the bills.
Yeah.
Well, it's a little bit out of responsibility. It's like, I don't know where this is all going, but as long as I can, I'm going to be here and take care of business
while
I can. And it's like, what else are you going to do in the hospital?
That's fortunately, true. That's true.
Fortunately, the World Cup was actually happening on. So I got to, I did spend a lot of time watching soccer matches. Okay. But yeah, I mean, I just, I worked out of my house. So it was just nobody on the other end of the line knew any different. I was on conference calls and,
No weird beeping in the background.
Well, once in a while, the machine would go off. Yeah.
What is that? Don't worry about that.
Yeah. One of the things you don't realize is how attached you're basically attached to the IV stand the entire time. They would take me off for 1 hour a day when they finally wanted to change things out. And I was able to, you know, grab a shower or something. It was like being set free.
Yes. Freedom.
Total freedom to be, to have this thing. Cause otherwise 23 hours a day, this thing is by your side, and every time you move across the room, you got to, you know, roll it with you. If you want to go take a walk down the hall, you got to unplug it, walk it with you.
So with leukemia, I'm assuming it's kind of like the same as all the others. There's stages.
Not really. No, it's a, so blood cancers, you can think of it as a very different category than, you know, sort of tumor based cancers. Yeah.
Okay.
So what's the next big thing for Spartan or for, I'm sorry, the name of your company again?
Genesis.
Genesis.
The next big thing, I don't know. We're actually searching for that right now. You know, we're trying to, from a Spartan perspective, trying to become a little bit more integrated into people's lives. You know, from a mission standpoint, the stated mission is to change 100 million people's lives. Rip people off the couch, sort of get them back to their primal selves. Stop complaining about, you know, your coffee being too cold and you know, we used to run away from dinosaurs to survive for the day. Right. So get over it, and kind of deal with life. So we're trying to, evolve, out of, you know, being synonymous with obstacle racing and into, a way of life basically.
Okay.
So, how you train, providing training content for people, the clothes you wear, how you feel, the way you act, you know, being charitable, seeking things out like that. So it's kind of the higher mission. But it's a challenge. It's, you know, people, you made your name in the world one way, and now you're kind of trying to
tweak it and grow your audience.
It'll be all encompassing there. Yeah. It's kind of.
So we've added, so just simple examples. We started putting on trail races this year, just straight up trail races, no obstacles. Okay. So just to reach another community of people, we do. We have kids races at all of our events, but we also have put on a couple of standalone kids races. Mm. And in China, they had one this year that had over 7,000 kids at it.
Wow.
We've got a licensee in the Middle East. They've actually run all women's races over in the Middle East. So yeah, we get letters every week, people who, you know, have found the brand and, talk about how it's changed their lives. They're on some dark path and, kind of gave them a focus and a mission and a purpose to, go a different way.
It becomes a family. Like you start meeting people that have the same thing and you just kind of, it empowers them.
Yeah. Definitely. The same way we were talking about before, how, you know, in adventure racing was so niche and you basically wound up knowing everybody. People would, you know, still stay in contact today through those networks. It's like that. I mean, it's on a broader scale. There's a lot more people who participate in obstacle racing now.
Now, do you guys do the season pass?
Is yep.
That you? That's mm-hmm. what I thought.
We do.
And that is just that good for it. Anywhere in like the U.S. for any race?
Yep, we do. We do a full season pass for.
So you can just pay the one price and then get into whatever race you mm-hmm. want.
Yep, people. We have people who race over 20 times a year with us. Yeah.
Pretty incredible.
That is pretty incredible. That's fantastic.
Well, we definitely appreciate you coming on, but before we let you go, based on your experiences, what is the most important piece of advice you can give our listeners?
Got a lot of them at this point in my life. You know, I think it's as we talked about, when we started adventure racing, like I said, I went to that camp, and at the end of that week, after only a few days of training, they're going to put us through a 100-mile course. You're like, my God, how am I going to make 100 miles? I've never done anything close to being that long. And what you realize is you just get to the first checkpoint. Like, that's thing one. Like, okay, the first checkpoint is 4 miles away. We got to go climb that mountain, go over there and find it. You do that. You celebrate it. You go, okay, now you go to Now you go to the second checkpoint. So to me, it's about always mapping out a plan. Whatever you're going to do, running a marathon might seem, or running the 200-mile relay might seem audacious to you right now. But if you start breaking it down, go, okay, well, look, if we get 9 more people, a couple of vans, we only have to run 17 miles. I could start training for that, start doing two times a week, three times, or four times. You can map your way out to whatever it is that you want to get to. So I think you got to have that plan. And then, of course, as we've talked about a number of times tonight, you got to be ready for changes in that plan. Something's going to happen, right?
Oh, yeah.
Plan B.
Hopefully it's not cancer. But something's going to go wrong. Your boats aren't going to show up. you're going to get sick and not be able to train for a week or two when you thought you were going to get ready for your big race. These things, that's life. That's what's going to happen. So you've got to be ready to adapt off of that.
That's gold what you said, though. Just get to the first checkpoint, because you're right. Once you get started and you just focus on that first checkpoint, whatever that might be in your life, then you're on your way. And certainly, I feel like most of the battle.
It takes that broad picture that seems very daunting and then brings it to like, okay, here. And then like you're saying.
That's how I used to CrossFit. I'd be like, all right, round one, let's get that underway.
That's funny because, when we worked out. Never mind. We're going to end there.
But go ahead. Did you have more than that?
No.
I think that's fantastic.
We appreciate it for sure.
Thanks a lot for coming in.
Guys, please share our stuff on social media. And if you got any questions, comments, concerns, you can email us at fullgorillalife@gmail.com.
And if you want to follow us on social media, Instagram. No.
Please follow us on.
My bad, I missed the plead. Instagram, Facebook, at fullgorillalife, and on Twitter, at gorillafull, like beautiful, but with a gorilla.
And if you want to check us out, you can visit us at our website with fullgorilla.life. And please do not forget to hit subscribe on your podcast app of choice.
Please.
Later. Right.
Take care.
Thank you.